This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Oh, that sounds good. Okay, well, welcome to this evening's lecture. Again, my name is Joshua Chestnut, and I'm pretty sure this, when I titled this lecture a number of months ago, it's called The Book of Job and the Wild Edge of Sorrow. And so, yeah, we're going to talk about Job. So Job is a demanding book in many ways. It is a complicated book, and I'm going to try to do our best to just, we'll both get our heads around the big picture of what's happening in Job and look at some key parts in particular. But as a way into this, the Book of Job, which is one of the Bible's richest collections of poetry, and arguably the Bible's most insider account of human suffering, I want to read a poem by a modern Israeli poet, a man named Yehuda Amichai. And actually, I won't read the entirety of the poem. I'm just going to read a section of it. And it's called The Precision of Pain. So this is Yehuda Amichai. And if you're at all interested, there's a collection of poetry called The Joy Anthology. This is the second poem, I believe, in the collection, if you want to read the rest of it. So he says this: I'm thinking how precise people are when they describe their pain in a doctor's office. Even those who haven't learned to read and write are precise. There's a throbbing pain. That one's a wrenching pain. This one gnaws. That one burns. This is a sharp pain. And that, a dull one. Right here. Precisely here. Yes, yes. Joy blurs everything. I've heard people say after a night of love and feasting, it was great. I was in seventh heaven. Even the spaceman who floated in outer space, tethered to a spaceship, could only say, great. Wonderful. I have no words. The blurriness of joy and the precision of pain. I want to describe with a sharp pain's precision happiness and blurry joy. I learned to speak among the pains. So of the Book of Job's 42 chapters, a large portion are Job's poetic explorations of the precision of pain. Job is someone who lost his 10 children, his wealth, his health, all the while enduring what he understood to be an unwarranted divine absence and judgment. Job laments and protests in great pain and with great precision. Yet, as I have sat with this book over the last few months, making my way through the many, many words which Job speaks in his poetry of pain, what has struck me most, and where I want to begin our time together this evening with Job, are words of his that we actually don't hear him say, but the narrator recounts them to us at the very end of the book. And so I should apologize to people with real literary sensibilities. I'm starting with the end of the book, which I know is not where you're supposed to be. But it's my lecture, and so we're going to move on. But this is an easily missed thing that Job does here, and it's understandably easy to miss for at least three reasons. One, it comes at the end of a very long, demanding book like Job. Job, a man who has learned to speak so powerfully, so poetically, so memorably among his pains, which he has poured out center stage for chapter after chapter. As he moves off stage, we overhear from an anonymous narrator some choice words of his that I just have found fascinating and wonderful, in the sense that I have wondered at them. They're full of reason to wonder to me. So not only does it happen at the end, it happens quickly, and nearly all contemporary translations, as good as they are, obscure it from those of us that don't read Hebrew. They often transliterate the Hebrew words. So you'll hear Jemima, Keziah, and Karen Hapuk, as you would if you read it in the ESV, which understandably you'll probably just breeze right over and move along. What do those words even mean? And also, the words occur in the closing scene of the book. We're going to do a very brief walkthrough of the book in a few minutes, but if you're familiar at all with the book, which I'm imagining you might be, since you're at a lecture about Job, the words occur in the closing scene, which I think many honest readers have found very disappointing and anticlimactic. They see it as a misguided and somewhat disturbing attempt on God's behalf to be right with Job, the suffering that transpired in the first and second chapter. It's almost like God is this abusive partner who's going to shower and abuse the abused with extra gifts or luxury items to somehow make up for the wrong that they did. Now, I don't think that's actually what's happening in the closing restoration of Job at the end of the book. And it's not what I want to focus on either. But that, with the fact that they're rarely translated, and that it comes at the end of the book, there are reasons why people miss these. But this is what's intrigued me, and again, they're words of the narrator, or they're words of Job that the narrator recounts to us. And so I just want to read the conclusion of the book, and I'm going to read it from a peculiar translation that I do commend. And if you're in the public library system around here, you can get it from the public library, like I did. This is Robert Alter's translation. He's a literary scholar at UC Berkeley. He is a non-believing, non-practicing Jew who has translated the whole Old Testament and thinks the Old Testament is like the peak of literature. Like, he loves it. He thinks it's the best. So he's a very fascinating man to read. And there's a freshness to his translations. But here's the conclusion of the book of Job. And the Lord blessed Job's later days more than his former days. And he had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camels and 1,000 yoke of oxen and 1,000 she-asses. Those are all sort of things he loses in the beginning of the book. And he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he called the name of his first daughter Dove. And the name of the second Cinnamon. And the third was named Horn of Eyeshadow. And there were no women in the land so beautiful as Job's daughters. Their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. And Job lived 140 years after this. And he saw his children and his children's children 4 generations. And Job died aged and sated in years. It's these names that Job gives his daughter that intrigue me. Dove, Cinnamon, and Horn of Eyeshadow. And again, they're often just put as Jemima, Keziah, or Karen Hapuk in many translations, so it's understandable why you miss them. But how does someone like Job, who has lost so much, who is sort of the emblem of pain and suffering and speaking out of misery and bitterness, someone who in his extreme protest over his suffering and pain cursed the day of his own birth, longed for the solace of death, and loathes his own life, how does he come to a place where he could even consider having children anymore? I heard it said that after World War II, many Jews believed the most courageous act of faith was for them to again have children, to trust God with more defenseless little ones. But so not only does Job have sex with his wife, and together they welcome 10 children into this world, he gives his daughter such wildly delightful, sensuous, and profoundly non-Jewish sounding names. Dove, Cinnamon, and Horn of Eyeshadow. Names that are evocative, they're full of delight. Names that are inherently celebratory, maybe even luxurious. Names that are strange and lovely at the same time. And names that reveal a delight in our existence. But there's also a little bit more. It's not just what he says to them. It's not just what he names them. Not only does he speak joyous, sensuous, and celebratory names over them, he gives them an inheritance, something not only unnecessary, but most likely quite an affront and sociably questionable in the male-dominated society of the ancient Near East. his act to do so goes well beyond any Old Testament standard legislation for inheritance, as daughters aren't supposed to receive inheritance. They're not supposed to get anything. So Job names and acts in a way of a person who has what the French might call joie de vie, is that, or how do you say it? Yeah, sure. A profound delight in simply being alive. He's not afraid to break with custom in order to honor and provide for his daughters alongside his sons. And he gives them these evocative, wonder-inducing names which sound like celebratory exclamations on the goodness of life in the world God has made. Now, I know I've begun at the end and I've sort of fixated on these seemingly insignificant details. And as someone who is not a Hebrew scholar or a Job scholar, I will fully admit they might be just that, insignificant details. But if you know anything about the book of Job, and I assume you do, and hopefully by the end of this night we will, there really is something different about this presentation of Job at the very end than we see in our previous encounters with him in the book. And so what I want to do is I printed out this handout for you that you can take home. This is not my own. This comes from the Bible Project. And if people are listening to this on the podcast, they can pause the lecture, go to the Bible Project's website, and find their chart that walks you through the book of Job. Now, Job is a massive book. It's 42 chapters. And this is really a 35,000-foot overview of the book. And it walks through really what goes on. So I'm going to start up in the right corner and just point out, it says unique book in the Bible. And it's partly unique because it's set in a land called Uz that we know nothing about other than it's named here. All the characters are non-Israelites. And there's really no other clear historical markings. Job is spoken of as a historical real person in Ezekiel, which we had a lecture about last week, as well as the letter to James. So I do think he's a real person, but it's the historical grounding of the text isn't front and center in the author's mind. Now, if you look at the whole kind of bottom chart here, you see a basic breakdown of the book of Job. So you have three boxes, really. So there's 1 to 2 on the left, and then on the right you have 42. And those are the prose parts of the book. The beginning of the book, the introduction, as well as the epilogue. In the middle of the book, the vast body of the book is poetry. Either Job's poetry, some of his friends' poetry, or Yahweh's poetry, the Lord's poetry in response to Job. And so we'll just walk through this briefly so we get an idea of what's happening in the book, because I want to just look at a few key parts. We're going to look at one of Job's protests in particular, as well as Yahweh's speeches to him. And so when Job is introduced in the very beginning, in this very little box on the left side, and you might need to be in a better lit room or take out the flashlight on your phone to be able to see it a little bit better, but he's introduced as a really upstanding human being. He's blameless, he's righteous, he honors God, and he's a wealthy man, he has 10 children. He also seems to have something of arguably an overly anxious, sort of very scrupulous religiosity to him. He has real faith, but he sacrifices on his children's behalf just in case they might have sinned. So there's sort of a little bit of a hint at a controlling heart right there. And so we're introduced to Job, and then we're immediately brought to this divine court or divine council where God is there, and all of a sudden a character appears who's called Ha-Satan, or the Satan, which is not a proper name. Satan means the accuser or the adversary. And he shows up, and God is kind of boasting about Job. Job is a great guy. And the accuser says to him, he's really a great guy because he's rich, and he's taken care of, and life is good. But if you take that away from him, that's all that's keeping him from being good. So God then allows the adversary to take away Job's children, and then to inflict Job himself with these boils on his skin. And immediately, like the little box right here says, why? Immediately, as a reader, you're like, oh, why would God allow this to happen? And I think that's a very reasonable question, but it is not the question the book sets out to answer. So if you're looking for that answer of exactly why this happened, the book will be a continual disappointment to you. But Job loses all that he has, and he finds himself on this ash heap. And his wife comes up to him and tells him to curse God and die. And then he has three friends appear, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, who come from different countries. They come and they sit silent with him for 7 days. After these 7 days, we move to this next box, 33 to 37. And this begins a long debate that's all in poetry between Job and these three friends. If you look up in the top left-hand corner of this chart, you're going to see that there's a cycle to this debate. Job says something, then friend one responds, then Job responds to friend one, then friend two speaks up, then Job responds to friend two, then friend three speaks up, then Job responds again. And it's easy to get lost in this part of the book. It's very heavy. Job speaks out of the bitterness of his soul. But they all, both Job and his friends, have what the Bible Project here call a big assumption, that the world works a certain way. And so if people behave, if they are wise and good, God's justice means that they'll have success. They'll be rewarded. Life will be good for them. They also believe if human action is evil or stupid, as the Bible Project puts it here, they will receive disaster and punishment. So this is sort of the underlying understanding of how the world works. And so Job is saying he's suffered these things, but he's innocent. That's his basic argument that he goes through over and over. The implication is that his suffering is not divine justice, which means either, as it says there, conclusion A, God doesn't run the world according to justice, or conclusion B, God is actually unjust himself. And his friends respond to this, and they say, of course God is just. God runs the world according to this sort of justice, where bad things happen to bad people, good things happen to good people. And so they say, you must have sinned. You must have done something to deserve the suffering you have. So this is the nature of the protest back and forth. And there is a guy who shows up in the end. He's young. He's a bit of a punk. His name's Elihu. And he sort of pretends, he presents himself as he's about to say something new, but I don't think he really does. That God is just, he runs the world according to good, that same sort of assumption about justice or retribution. And yeah, so that's sort of the nature of all that. Now next to that, they give you an example of some of what Job's protest sounds like all throughout this. They quote a few verses. Like, why has God denied me justice and made my life bitter? God attacks me, tears me up in anger, and gnashes his teeth at me. He destroys the blameless and the wicked, and he mocks the despair of the innocent. What hope do the godless have when God takes away their life? So all throughout this, Job is saying some pretty dark things. We're going to read a little bit more of those in detail, get a fuller taste of them. But his concluding argument is basically, I'm innocent. And he wants an explanation from God on why this has happened. He demands that God give him a response. And then in chapter 38, we've been going through this we've just been talking about this book for like a few minutes, and I'm already exhausted. But after 37 chapters of this, the Lord shows up, and he responds to Job. We're going to spend some time there later this evening going more in depth. And he speaks out of a whirlwind to Job. He speaks out of a storm. And at first, he takes Job on this tour of the cosmos. And he asks Job a series of questions about what Job knows. And Job's response, more or less over and over, is he just doesn't know. He wasn't there to know how these things are. Mm-hmm. And the implication, as it says here in this one box, Job doesn't have a universal vantage point. So Job actually isn't in a position to accuse God, because there's just so much he doesn't understand. And Job responds very well, actually, to that. He kind of shuts up. And then Yahweh has another speech. The Lord has another speech to Job. that is a long description of two creatures. These mythological creatures, these symbolic creatures that show up throughout the Old Testament, Behemoth and Leviathan. They show up in Isaiah, they show up quite a bit in the Psalms, they show up in the Prophets, and they're characters that represent disorder and chaos. They're agents of chaos at work in the world. And so through this, God presents a picture of his world as good, but not perfect, as ordered, but still full of wildness, as beautiful, but also quite dangerous. And he asks, again, the question, why is there suffering in this world? And the response, not directly, is, but we live in a world that is not designed to prevent suffering. That suffering is still part of this world. We'll go through this more a little bit later. And then comes that's the end of the poetry. And it moves back and closes with a short prose epilogue we read a part of. But before the part where Job is restored, where he has more children, he says to God that he repents, he recants, he takes it back. And God says to Job, you've actually spoken properly of me. You've spoken accurately of me, but your friends have not. The friends with this very neat and tidy ordered universe have not. And I like what they highlight here. We're going to highlight some of this in the talk too. But God honors Job's struggle, his honesty, and he honors his prayer, his directness. And then from there we see how the story ends with Job being restored and him having these pretty wildly named daughters. So again, I know that's 35,000 feet. I know it's quick. I actually know it's quite a bit of information. but hopefully it's helpful and you can take it with you, or you can leave it behind if you're not interested. But I hope then it becomes clear or apparent. There's a lot in this book that we're not going to touch on tonight. But what I am curious about, the question is how someone who has lost so much, who, as we'll see, is very much in touch and very eloquent, very precise about the pain that he feels, how does he become someone who would give his daughters celebratory, life-affirming names, as well as share an inheritance with them that was culturally unheard of? How did this transformation happen with this guy? What goes on here through this really unbelievable suffering? And instead of waiting until the very end, I want to go ahead and put it out there. I mean, I've already told the end of the story, so I might as well kind of give some of the punchline of the lecture away up front. And I think it's important to do this because, again, it's a biblical book that talks a lot about God, suffering, the nature of evil. And so people understandably assume the book of Job is going to answer the question of why God allows suffering and evil. And if that is your question, it is a fantastic question. It is not a question that the book of Job gives an answer to. It's doing something else. So in this little book, which is an introduction to the Old Testament called Getting Involved with God by Old Testament scholar Ellen Davis, she has a chapter on the book of Job. And she writes this. It's a very interesting essay. She's a great Old Testament scholar, I think. Even though I disagree with her all over the place, she's very interesting. She says this, the book of Job is about human pain. It's also about theology, the work of speaking about God. In the last chapter, God takes Job's friends to task, saying, you have not spoken accurately about me, as has my servant Job. Here God is pointing obliquely to what is so remarkable about this book. It shows us a person in the sharpest imaginable pain, yet speaking accurately about God. Job gives us immeasurably more than a theology of suffering. It gives us the theology of a sufferer. In it we hear authoritative speech about God that comes from lips taut with anguish. The sufferer who keeps looking for God has in the end privileged knowledge. The one who complains to God, pleads with God, rails at God, does not let God off the hook for a minute. She is at last admitted to a mystery. She passes through a door that only pain will open, and is thus qualified to speak of God in a way that others, whom we generally call more fortunate, cannot speak. Now, earlier this term, we had a lecture by a local youth pastor named Jared and Dick, and he was a former missionary to the Ukraine. And he shared a lecture about living with unanswered questions and significant disappointment in how life has worked out. Disappointment in God with how life has worked out. It's a lecture, to be honest, I've thought about every single day since he gave the lecture. And he shared honestly about his own story. But what sat with me is he shared about how in Genesis 17, when God reestablishes a covenant with Abraham, who was at the time of this 99, the Lord says to Abraham, this is how you read it in many translations, "I am the Lord Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless." Jaredon highlighted how to walk means the way we conduct our lives, the way we live out our lives. But he said, if you parse out quite woodenly what it means before me, this language before me, it means in my face. God is telling Abraham, live your life in my face and you will be blameless. We can read this as two different things, he says. Live your life in my face or walk before me and be blameless. But he says that grammatically, it's actually just one. Live your life in my face and you will be blameless. The Lord calls, the Lord invites, he requires honest engagement with him. To cry out to him in confusion and sorrow, to wrestle with him in difficulty, to get in his face when he hasn't lived up to the expectations he has placed upon himself. The book of Job is an account of this sort of faith in the extreme. And at the end of the book, God says Job has spoken rightly of God, even though, as we'll see briefly, and we'll get a bit of a taste of, he says things that are probably are not theologically correct. In his pain, Job speaks of God actually as a moral monster. But they're precise words of pain, and they're not merely spoken about God. They're spoken to God. He remains in God's face throughout the whole book. And this comes as a distinction to Job's friends who come to console him. And they come from far corners of the world. I think they're supposed to represent some of the smartest wisdom of the world. But I think they're actually just interested in protecting their own butts. I don't think they care that much about Job. I mean, they do initially. They sit with him for 7 days, which is quite amazing, in silence. It's actually become a practice of sitting Shiva with someone, sitting for 7 days as they suffer. It starts with these guys. So these guys start in the right place, but they can't help but talking and explaining things. And they have a theological scheme that is neat and tidy. And in that scheme, the catastrophe which came upon Job came upon him because he deserved such a disaster. Bad things happen to bad people. Good things happen to good people. This is sometimes called retribution theology. You get what you get and you don't get upset. And in a way, Job shares some of this, because Job's continued response is, I don't deserve this suffering. I'm innocent. Suffering shouldn't come to innocent people. What is going on in the world? And the friends, this theological scheme, I think it's trying to save their butts because it keeps all suffering at arm's length. Right? As long as they're good and do what's right, nothing bad's going to happen to them. It's going to keep them safe. And the fact that Job hasn't done anything wrong and something bad has happened to him is a major threat to their own thinking. It's a major threat to how they understand the world. But it keeps Job, they think it's going to keep suffering at arm's length. It's not the best way to keep suffering at arm's length. Just keep thinking, I'm going to do good and no bad's going to come to me. But it keeps Job at arm's length too. Their attempts to console Job, he calls them quack doctors. They are not good at what they do. But it not only keeps reality at arm's length away from them, it keeps sufferers like Job away from them, it keeps God at arm's length away from them. You can't live in God's face if you determine when suffering happens to whom and by whom. If you're the one who sets the rules on how the universe works, You're holding God at arm's length and telling him how it's supposed to be. Their strict retribution principle, what the Bible Project calls the justice assumption, doesn't allow God to act or behave beyond our understanding of how reality works. It domesticates the Lord's wise and glorious transcendence, the very thing that Job gets a first-hand taste of in his tour of the cosmos that happens in Yahweh's speeches. I could say more, but I want to actually give a taste of how someone like Job, someone who's living in God's face and is innocent and undeserving of the suffering, they can't make sense of the suffering that's happening in their life. Someone who's living in God's faith, what do their words maybe sound like? I was, admittedly, for years, the only words of Job I was familiar with were from a worship song that I actually quite like, called Blessed Be Your Name by Matt Redman. And it says, you give and you take away, blessed be your name, which Job says. But then he says a whole lot more beyond that. He goes a lot further than that. In fact, more or less the next thing we hear him say after this is what I'm going to just read the third chapter of Job. And this is the first words of Job that now that Job speaks. So Job is actually, the friends are sitting in silence with Job for 7 days, which is amazing. But Job is also silent. Once Job opens his mouth, they can't keep their mouths closed. So there's something there too. Again, I'm reading from Robert Alter's translation. And I actually, for the most part, quite like many of the other translations that I've read alongside. I'm not choosing his because I think all the others are wrong or something. But this is Job 3. Afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day. And Job spoke up and he said, annul the day I was born, and the night that man said, or a night that said, a man is conceived. That day let it be darkness. Let God above not seek it out, nor brightness shine upon it. Let darkness, death's shadows, foul it. Let a cloud mass rest upon it. Let a day gloom dismay it. That day let murk overtake it. Let it not join the days of the year. Let it not enter the number of months. Oh, let that night be barren. Let it have no song of joy. Let the day cursers hex it, those ready to rouse Leviathan. Let its twilight stars go dark. Let it hope for a day in vain, and let it not see the eyelids of dawn. For it did not shut the belly's door to hide wretchedness from my eyes. Why did I not die in the womb? From the belly come out, breathe my last. Why did knees welcome me? And why breasts that I should suck? For now I would lie and be still, would sleep and no repose, with the kings and counselors of earth who build ruins for themselves, or with princes, possessors of gold who fill their houses with silver, or like a buried stillborn I'd be, like babes who never saw light. There the wicked cease their troubling, and there the weary repose. All together the prisoners are tranquil. They hear not the taskmaster's voice. The small and the great are there. The slave is free of his master. Why give light to the wretched and life to the deeply embittered? Who wait for vain and death, dig for it more than treasure? Who rejoice at the tomb and are glad when they find the grave? To a man whose way is hidden and God has a hedge about him. Before my bread, my moaning comes, and my roar pours out like water. For I feared a thing, and it befell me. What I dreaded came upon me. I was not quiet. I was not still. I had no rest, and trouble came. So that is the first section of poetry, and it stays at that level of intensity. So it is an exhausting, demanding book. And in many ways, I just want the words to stand on their own. I don't want to do too much expounding. Because, again, I just don't think it's a book that is often heard or used by Christians in their life with God. But these are words of someone who lived their life in God's face. There's a number of Old Testament scholars, though, who do point out this is not only just cursing the day of his birth. This opening poem is filled with words that are central to the creation account in Genesis 1. the pairing of the day and the night, darkness and light. They think that Job here attempts to declare, "Let there not be," over his own life and really the entirety of creation. And it's not only here where Job is going to sort of turn or subvert previous used biblical language or imagery. He actually does this all over the place. Some of it's a little subtle, some of it's not as subtle. But let me start by reading Job 7:16-18, which sounds a lot like Psalm 8:3-4. Well, or part of it, a section of it does. He says this in Job 7, "I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are a breath. What is man that you make so much of him, that you set your heart on him, visit him every morning and test him every day?" This sounds to me so much like an inversion of Psalm 8. Psalm 8, which says, "When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him?" Job again is speaking in tremendous bitterness and grief, but he remains in God's face, and he's almost using God's words against him. And in a way that captures, I think, how dizzying and confusing and disorienting suffering can be. In this one, he's saying, in Job 7, he's saying, what is man that you pay so much attention to him? Leave me alone. He wants God to leave him alone. By Job 23, he can't find God. He wants to find God and argue his case with God, but he says God isn't anywhere to be found, and he does it in an interesting way. This is Job 23:8-9. He said, "Look, I go to the east, he's not there. To the west, I don't discern him. To the north, where he acts, I behold him not. He veils the south, and I do not see him." Sounds to me reminiscent in many ways. It echoes the language of Psalm 139. "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there." So there's a lot of this pouring out in Job's precise poetry of pain. But it is characteristic of someone who is living their life in God's faith when they are in a state of suffering, pain, and confusion. And because, I mean, even just reading the one chapter is exhausting. I'm not going to read any more of that. And I'm going to move to Yahweh's response, the Lord's response, which is this second column over here, which admittedly is also very confusing. But God shows up in chapter 38 to respond to Job. And it seems as though he talks about everything and anything other than what we want him to tell us about. I will admit, on many, many reads of this part of Job, I haven't read Job many, many, many times because it's a big, exhausting book. But many times that I've read this, I found Yahweh's response anticlimactic at best. And honestly, I've just found it often avoidant, self-aggrandizing, and kind of mean-spirited. But however dissatisfying I find these speeches of the Lord, Job didn't. They're anything but anticlimactic to him, which has gotten me curious about what is going on in these speeches. After the first speech, Job steps back and admits he was wrong to accuse God of being against him, of God being his enemy. He actually says somewhat infamously, if you know, you might have heard this line in Job if you've heard some. He says, "I heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." And I read it from the ESV that time in particular, not to pick on the ESV, but because it's a beautiful line, but it actually adds something that's not there in the Hebrew and not necessary in the Hebrew. And it makes Job sound like his response is deeply self-loathing. But there's actually no direct object in the Hebrew there. He just says, "I despise," which is a way of also saying, "I recant, I was wrong." But the myself there is an addition that's not necessary. So Alter, reading Robert Alter has been helpful here. He says, he renders it, what is that one? It's the very end of, where he says, I despise myself in dust and ashes, which is...
Yeah. 41 or 2.
Yeah. But Alter has it this way. He says, by the ear's rumor, I heard of you, and now my eye has seen them. Therefore, I recant, and I repent in dust and ashes. So, this is his response to Yahweh's speeches. And, again, there's two distinct speeches. And there's a songwriter, a guy named David Bazan. Is anyone familiar with David Bazan's music? He used to go by Pedro the Lion. He also sort of summed up my sort of gut response to this in a song, called, In Stitches. And, wait, I didn't write the line down. I just wrote David Bazan. So, of course, now my brain can't remember how the line starts. But he says this. He says, when Job asked you the question, you responded, who are you, to criticize your maker. Well, if that part is true, it makes you sound defensive, like you had not thought this through. I think it's quite an interesting take on what Yahweh does here. And it captures some of how it feels anticlimactic. And the first speech that Yahweh gives to Job is really a protracted series of questions that pummel Job like waves. And they all have the same answer. No. The Lord asked Job initially some big cosmic questions. Job has brought his case and he's demanding God's response. And God's response is, he asked Job if he was there when the foundations of the earth were laid, or if he was the one who shut the seas, if he could command the stars to rise, if he knows the depths of the ocean, something we don't currently know, I think, even in 2024, if he knows the way to the dwelling of light and to the place of darkness, if he knows where the snow and hail are kept, or where the east wind comes from. The Lord asked Job if he knows where the rain comes from, if he's able to control constellations or even clouds. Can he make lightning and thunder? And then the Lord's line of questioning moves. It moves from these big cosmic matters, and he starts talking about wild animals. And he asks Job question after question that, again, he must answer in the negative. Questions like, can you hunt for a lion to feed their young? Can you provide for a raven? What about the place where the mountain goats give birth? Do you know where that is? Who let the wild donkey go free, but also brings it to home? The same with the ox. Then he asks if he knows the nature of the wings of an ostrich, which is a bird that doesn't really fly, I don't think. And then he comments about how the ostrich will lay an egg and then trample it in its own clumsiness. The Lord asks Job about the wild horse and the hawk. And Job's response to these questions is that he really is of small account. Job says he's going to lay his hand over his mouth. And like the Bible Project summary chart says, Job realizes he doesn't have a universal vantage point on things. There's lots of things he doesn't understand. But I don't think the intention of Yahweh's questions is just to smother and belittle Job, as it is to point Job to the person who can answer in the affirmative to these questions. And there is this very interesting movement from the establishment of creation to the care of wild creatures. Amidst the wildness of God's creation, he speaks with some unusually gentle imagery. He talks about using darkness as a swaddling cloth for clouds, like putting darkness as a diaper on the clouds. And you get this, there's many things like this. He talks about how there's rain that happens in deserts that no one sees and no one experiences except for Yahweh. And he delights in it. You get the impression that there is nothing, no personified natural phenomenon, to the most bizarre, unusual animals, like an ostrich, that are not part of the Lord's care and not outside of his attention. You also very much get the sense that the world is not anthropocentric. It doesn't just revolve around humans. There's much more going on. And in all of this, the Lord has delight in the wildness and the strangeness of his creation. Now, again, it's an unusual response to Job and his suffering. But Job responds to it quite profoundly. It makes sense to Job in some way. And I think part of what makes sense, or maybe part of what it's after, that is also true in the second speech, is this idea that the Lord speaks from a whirlwind to Job. The Lord enters the conversation actually, like grammatically, the exact same way every other character does. Every friend, it's, and Eliphaz said to Job, and Bildad said to Job, and this it says, and the Lord responded to Job. In the same way, he enters in the same manner that everyone else does. But he speaks from the midst of a storm, from a whirlwind. What is that all about? I wonder if this understanding something to this whirlwind is a key to opening the door, an interpretive key to opening the door to make sense of what's going on in the book of Job. It might not be. Again, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but it might be. It's quite interesting. And my thinking on this has been informed by a book called Suffering Wisely and Well, The Grief of Job and the Grace of God by Eric Ortlund, who I believe is the big brother to the guy who wrote Gentle and Lowly. So they are an accomplished family. And I admit, I've always just assumed God speaking from a storm was a way that he emphasized his power and his majesty. And while I don't think that's wrong, I don't think the Lord spoke from a whirlwind just to offer a spectacle to impress and overwhelm Job. The way athletes pull up in really expensive cars or rappers show off their bling. There's actually other moments in Israel scripture where the Lord shows up in a whirlwind. In fact, the exact same word for whirlwind is used for the Lord's appearance three times in the minor prophets. And in each time, it's a way to speak about the way the Lord is working to defend and protect his people from their enemies. The first comes in Nahum. And Nahum is a specific word of judgment on the people of Nineveh. If you know anything in the Bible, you know Nineveh is the place where Jonah goes and they repent. There's this sort of, you know, big thing. It doesn't stay that way. And these people were a brutal, violent people that really were deep enemies of Israel. And so Nahum is a word about God defending his weak people from the brutality of Nineveh. So that's some of the context for these words that are harsh. Or again, not words you hear often in sermons or on Sunday morning. So this is from Nahum 1. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries and keeps wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. And the Lord will by no means clear the guilty. His way is in whirlwind and storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. So here, the Lord is showing up to defend his people who are being oppressed by an enemy, they're about to be swallowed up by an enemy. In Habakkuk 3, Habakkuk speaks of the Lord's work in defending his people from their enemies and said, "You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked. You pierced him with his own arrows. You came like a whirlwind. You trampled the sea with your horses." And then in Zechariah 9, again, "The Lord will appear over them, and his arrow will go forth like lightning. The Lord God will sound the trumpet and go forth in whirlwind. The Lord of hosts will protect them. On that day, the Lord will save them. for how great is his goodness and how great his beauty. In these distinct accounts of whirlwind appearances of the Lord, there's the exact same connotation in each one by three different authors. The Lord goes to war on his defenseless people's behalf against greater powers that would otherwise swallow them whole. Ortland says this: "This means that the Lord's awesome appearance in thunder and lightning is not a general way of speaking about divine power only. It is an Old Testament way of describing God's glorious defeat of the chaos and evil that resists his rule, all in order to save those who trust him. Although modern readers would not make this association, when God appears in the storm, it is to do battle and to rescue his people." So whatever it is that God is conveying in these speeches, it is his way of letting Job know that he's not some absentee landlord for the cosmos. And while we don't get an answer as to why the Lord allows evil in this world to afflict his servants, he's telling us that he is actively fighting against it, and he will not let it swallow them whole. This becomes more clear in the second speech of Yahweh, which is also very strange in many ways and takes, I think, a few reads to figure out, because it's going to spend so much time describing chaos creatures, Leviathan and Behemoth. So in the second speech that happens, again, the Lord is speaking out of a whirlwind, which is this imagery of fighting on his people's behalf against chaos and evil. He more or less just describes these creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan. And there's lots of references in the Psalms and in Isaiah and other places that speak of these as forces of evil, of chaos, that are at work in the world. They're symbolic creatures. And before moving into the description of these creatures, the Lord says this to Job. So then, again, this is the second speech. "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Dress for action, like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Have you an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like him?' And then he says this: 'Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowing of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring them low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then I will also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you.'" It's a strange thing that he says, but this idea of adorning yourself with majesty and dignity, clothe yourself with glory and splendor. This is how many other Old Testament passages speak of the Lord's glory before he heads into battle to fight for his people, either against human or supernatural powers. We see this in Exodus and in the Psalms. So it's almost as though the Lord is saying, get ready to fight. And then he spends about 10 verses describing this creature, Behemoth. And then we come to the beginning of chapter 1, and we get the longest description of anything in the Bible. I think there's a chapter in Moby Dick that's all describing, like, knots, right? This is the Bible's version of that. This is a whole chapter devoted to a physical description of one character. And I'm going to read it. I respect all of you. We can do this together. But just a taste of what's going on here.
Which chapter is this?
This is chapter 41. Okay. The description of Leviathan. And again, Leviathan shows up in different places. I can read some of them later. We can talk about it. He actually shows up in non-Israelite texts from that same time period as this chaos creature. And so the Lord says this: "Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook, or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose, or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as a bird? Or will you put him on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hands on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, the hope of a man is false. He is laid low even at the sight of him. No one is so fierce that he dares stir him up. Who then is he who can stand before me? Who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silence concerning his limbs, or his mighty strength, or his goodly frame. Who can strip off his outer garments? Who would come near him with a bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth is terror. His back is made of rows of shield, shut up closely as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezings flash forth fire, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. Out of his mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils come forth smoke, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame comes forth from his mouth. In his neck abides strength, and terror dances before him. The folds of his flesh stick together, firmly cast on him and immovable. His heart is hard as stone, hard as the lower millstone. When he raises him up, the mighty are afraid. At the crashing, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it does not avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He counts iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. For him, sling stones are turned to stubble. Clubs are counted as stubble. He laughs at the rattle of javelins. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads himself out like threshing sledge on the mire. He makes the deep boil like a pot, and he makes the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him he leaves a shining wake. One would think the deep to be white-haired. On earth there is not his like, a creature without fear. He sees everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. That's how God responds to Job. And it is... to be honest... the times that I've read the speech, I was just confused. Why this long description of a very strange creature? And why does Job have the response that he does? Job's response is, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore, I recant and repent in dust and ashes. That's sort of the end of how it goes. But in this speech, God reveals to Job a massive, writhing evil at loose in the world. And God has a deep, profound, intimate acquaintance with it. He knows this creature and can describe this creature intimately with great detail. He is not unaware. He's not unconcerned with the evil that is at work in his good but fallen world. The chaos that is vandalizing his shalom. For as aware as Job has been about his pain and suffering and the evil he has endured, God, I think, is in effect showing Job that he is more acutely aware of everything wrong with the world than Job is. Job's fear throughout his protests were that God doesn't care about evil and injustice. This must have vanished as God brings Job so close to this creature of chaos and evil. And he's prepared him to battle this evil. Job had thought he had seen the ugliest side of life in his suffering, but now he hasn't even seen the half of it. But God has, and God isn't flinching in the face of this creature. I think showing him this strange creature also makes it abundantly clear that Job is not God's enemy. He has not treated Job as his enemy. Job has thought of the catastrophe of his life to be a sign that God was judging him, that God was angry with him, that God was abandoning him and avoiding him. He had lost friendship with God. But this is just not the case. There is real evil and chaos at work in the Lord's world. And again, the Lord does not answer why he allows evil to be, but he tells Job he is very much aware of it, more so than Job had been or ever could be, and that one day he will destroy the evil that he currently tolerates. It is Leviathan, it is evil and chaos and sin that the Lord is at war with, not Job. This speech must have also shown Job that the world is in one sense much worse, much more dangerous and fierce than Job could have ever suspected, because Leviathan, chaos and evil are more fearsome than he could have imagined. But he's also now realized that God is not afraid of it. God is not afraid of it at all. In fact, verse 12, which is a transition between these rhetorical questions about playing with Leviathan being and all that sort of stuff before the description, the Lord says, "I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his goodly frame." It's a very strange thing, but it's almost like the Lord in a moment is talking positively about this chaotic beast. It can't be a way of saying that Leviathan and chaos are good, but it is how God has appraised his opponent, and he's not worried about it. He's actually calm as he is heading into this battle against evil and chaos. Things that rightly terrify Job, God has instead surveyed his enemy and can say, oh, he has a goodly form. Yeah. It's wild to me that this encounter is what led to such a radical change in Job's life. It's wild. I cannot comprehend exactly what Job went through here. Portland says this: "If you are following a general into battle who showed courage in the face of death, you might be roused to imitate him. But what if your great captain and warrior looked on a dreadful, fearful enemy with calm and even a sense of serene happiness? What if an enemy that could easily kill you could not diminish your captain's unruffled cheerfulness in the battle? How would that make you look at your enemy differently? Leviathan looks at spears and swords as straw, but God looks at Leviathan like he is straw." So that is where the Lord ends his response to Job. And I just have a few concluding thoughts. I've already spoken for much longer than I hope to. That is the nature of a book like Job. But I think, if anything, there's a few things Job shows us. I don't know why, if you are suffering, or what suffering is in your life or another's life, I don't know why you are suffering. And the book of Job is not going to give you an explanation. But it gives you both an account of someone who chose to live their life in God's face, who spoke honestly, directly, rawly to the Lord about the suffering and pain they were going through. But in the same way that Job lived in God's face, God kind of lived in Job's face, especially at the end. God showed him that there's much going on that we can't see or we can't understand, and called Job to trust him, even if Job doesn't understand all that is going on. Living in God's faith calls us to be honest about our pain, honest about our disappointment, and puts us on a path towards healing. We don't have to hide these things when we live before God. And in fact, even after this encounter with the Lord, it says that when Job's extended family came, they brought him rings, they brought him money, and they grieved with him. he still had grief that he had to work through. This wasn't the end of the story. And wisdom is not so much about what you do know, about being the smartest person in the room all the time. Wisdom is sometimes knowing what you don't know. And there's much that we can't know about our life. And wisdom is about the ability to live in a world where we can't shield ourselves or protect ourselves from suffering. And we need to realize that not all sufferings are the same. Some people suffer from a simple cause and effect. If you smoke cigarettes, you're probably going to expose yourself to lung cancer. Or if you live with someone who smokes, the secondhand smoke can do that to you. But Job's sufferings are not like that. Many people suffer for reasons they don't know or that we don't know. And I think Job calls us to pause reverentially, sit in silence with people who are suffering, and not just give them sort of the quick, easy, one-for-one justice ideas like Job's friends do. I'm going to stop there. I could say so much more. Job is a wild book. It's an amazing book, and I really don't understand most of it, which maybe you go picked up on. But at this point, it's a question and response time. You are free to get another cookie or use the bathroom, or even if you are done for the evening, but I'll answer or respond to any thoughts, any questions. Again, there's a lot in Job that we didn't even get near to covering. But yeah, Nikhil?
About where did the let there not be come from? Like, the let there be.
Yeah, so it's kind of, so Job doesn't say that explicitly,
right.
Yeah, it's just because there's so much kind of echoing in that of Genesis 1. So there's all these creation language. I mean, a lot of Old Testament scholars kind of say that when you hear things like couplets like day and night,
yeah,
you should think Genesis 1.
Yeah.
And like light and darkness, think Genesis 1. And so when he's saying, you know, annul the day and the night, let that day be darkness and there be no light to shine on it. Like he's pulling, it's sort of like an anti-creation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in Jeremiah also curses the day of his birth. And he more explicitly talks about a reversal of creation, basically about going back to being formless and void. So that Job isn't the only person in the Bible who curses the day of his birth. But this, Yes, yeah.
I'm just curious about something. So the prologue of Job, like you didn't talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He calls it the wager.
Yeah.
And kind of like we see behind the curtain and
yeah,
we know why.
Yeah, yeah. And Job never does.
And Job never does. So
yeah.
I'm just curious as to why you left that out.
There's just, to be honest, that I just talked about the things that I started to find really compelling about the book, and to me, I have lots of questions about the beginning of the book. I had even more questions about Yahweh's speeches. Like, what? Like, what are you talking about? Like, to be honest, I felt like God was a bit of a jerk to Job. And so that was just where I was interested. Like, but then clearly realizing, like, well, Job is a pretty different person after these. So, like, what's going on? I mean, I have thoughts on the beginning, but I just, I sometimes also hear people talk about Job and talk a lot about 1 and 2, and it does seem to place it almost, you know, I do think the book is pretty philosophical. Like, it's asking really big questions and wrestling with huge questions about meaning and purpose and reality. But it's also, like the quote I read from the Old Testament scholar Ellen Davis, I think it's less the theology of suffering, like, why does suffering happen? Let's explain all the categories. And more, you get an insider's look on the theology of someone who is suffering, of a sufferer. And sometimes I've just found that I do think chapter 1 is very important. I'm not trying to say it's not important, but sometimes that's just, I find there's a lot of camping out there and a lot of speculative work on nature of evil and, yeah.
Well, God
yeah.
and Satan are hanging out together. I mean, it's just so much there.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. And, yeah.
God would take this wager.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems like the question of, his question is like, what is it? Does Job serve you for nothing? I think that's in many ways like a major, very much the heart of the book.
Right.
And God's implicated in that. It's not just really about Job. It's about like, can someone actually have a relationship with God and care for God and serve God, love God, without it be because God just does stuff for them. So I do think like it's very much, I think it's a pretty vital question. And, but yeah, I don't know. Do you have any more thoughts on or any more?
No,
you
no. I just have always. I mean, the Philippians' treatment of that. I think it's in disappointment with God. I'm not sure which one. I think it's that one. I thought that was the best I've ever read about it.
Yeah.
It's always fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing too. On like it's. I mean. The nature of this divine counsel of God who rules the world solely, but has this like counsel. That's what is that? I don't know. And even the way that you know who. How Satan becomes a proper name, you know, and like Satan becomes a person. But here it's almost like he shows up and he's just part of the cast. Like he's the accuser. He's the adversary. He's the cynic. He's not a neutral character at all. I've heard Tim Keller has a sermon on Job where he spends a little bit of time, but not a ton of time on it. And his take is kind of like, this is a way of talking about that, like a way of presenting the truth that like God is in control. And God allows evil, but is not the cause of evil. And it's presenting that. And so it's, it gets deep quick. So anyway, maybe I just was a little cowardly and wanted to avoid 1 and 2, but yeah. Dick, do you, yeah.
Yeah, I've been fascinated with that because it seems to me that God is, in the very beginning, he's initiating the most obnoxious picture of himself,
mm-hmm.
Sort of playing games.
Yeah.
But it raises the question, which is the very question God is not going to answer of Job.
Yeah,
why?
Yeah.
Why? And that's the thing.
He
lets go his family. He lets go his property. But he won't let go the question why.
Yeah.
And that's where I think you get the machine gun questions from God at the end.
Yeah.
But he lets himself be... He describes himself as the potentially the most obnoxious way. For those who want to know the question why.
Yeah. It raises the question, but then doesn't.
The whole book tells you.
Yeah.
An answer to this question is not worth that.
Yeah, Marty.
Well, I'm just thinking, Satan's cynicism, you know, God, he doesn't worship you for nothing. He worships you because you've given him all this stuff. And yet God is saying, no, he is my servant. He really is my servant. And he serves me for naught, simply because I'm God. Job hangs on to that question, why? That's the stumbling block for him that keeps him from worshiping God for nothing, because he wants the answer to that. And then in the end, when he is somehow humbled, definitely humbled by all these... by God's questioning him.
Yeah.
And then he is worshiping God without the answer to his question.
Yeah.
He's worshiping God for naught.
Yeah.
Simply because God is God and worthy of worship. And
yeah.
That's not...
And God repeats my servant.
My servant.
Sorry, yeah.
Chapter 42.
I know. Yeah, it's so great. He's never. Yeah, he's always like my. Or what does he say to the friends? He's like, my. You have not spoken rightly about me. Like my servant Job has, and it's like every chance. It's not just Job. It's like my servant Job. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. Yeah, Mary Frances.
Yeah, this is just a comment tied on to that, but I haven't, it's been a couple years since I've read Job. But I just remember years ago, Dick and Marty's pastor did a talk here, and I don't even know, he wasn't talking about Job, I don't remember what he was talking about. But this just stuck with me, is he made this comment about how so often our question is why. Mm-hmm. Like, that is so often our question, and not that that's a bad question or a wrong question, but the like ultimately the question is who.
Hmm.
Not why, but who. Mm-hmm. And to me, like, that's what I was thinking of the whole time you were talking. Hmm. It's like that's actually the question that the book of Job is answering.
Mm-hmm.
Is who, because it's a different, you think of, like, especially in the Old Testament, the other ways that we learn about God, right? That we see these different characteristics of God, his love, his justice, his right, all these different things. And this is just, to me, it feels quite different from the other prophets, from other parts of we're coming at it from a different door.
Yeah.
Coming in the room from a different door of, like, of who is this God? And there is this sense of just his, I don't even know what the word, I can't even come up with the word. I don't even know what the word is. Like, it's not grandeur, it's not, that's not what it is, but to me, that's just what I'm struck by, is that you step out of this with, to the point of, like, no answer to the question why, but a fuller answer to the question who.
Yeah, it's also sort of, I mean, connected with that too, and with not getting the answer to his question. Like, he seemed to actually live quite a, I mean, it's almost like the Old Testament's version of happily ever after.
Right.
But you get more, you get a little bit more, and that's what I was picking up on with how he named his daughters and then gave them inheritance. Like, he's like moved to California and like gone, like sold the families.
Yeah.
Sold the family estate, and he's just like living on a commune, like growing flowers. And he's like a joy, like it seems like he's a joyful person who is very much in touch with himself and with God and with the world, and like living with stuff that I don't know he'll ever get what he wanted, but he's found something else, it seems like. Yeah. Kathy.
I'm going along with what Mary Frances was saying. I was struck when I read, I had two Jewish friends who just were incensed at God's response to poor Job. He's gone through all of this. And look at, who does he think he is? You know, this God of it. But, you know, in my reading it again and again, I get it as, I've heard all about you. I know all about you. I've listened to 50 zillion Liberty lectures. I'm really up on it, you know.
Yeah.
And now my eyes have seen thee.
Yeah.
And it is a who. Mine eyes have seen thee now after all this, you know.
Yeah.
And I just was struck by that, you know. It was that God does answer.
Yeah.
In a very profound way.
Yeah.
Enough for Job to come around and say, I see you now. I understand.
Yeah.
And then to have this real happily ever after.
Yeah.
You know, he does have this transformation.
In a
major
way. No, I know. And there's like, I think you're giving a comment about like, I've read, I know, I've listened to like a million Labrie lectures. I do feel like, that's, there are some, I mean, and I, as someone who just, maybe gave the most recent Labrie lecture that anyone has given. I have some belief in them. There is a point where it's like, you can't like podcast and conference your way in like into reality. Like you need an encounter with a God that is real and alive. And like you can't keep just so I really liked how you said that. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, Jared.
I wonder if what wisdom, if any, is offered to folks who see themselves not necessarily in Job, but in his friends. So I've, you know, in some small way have felt like Job, but in looking back, I often have been Job's friends and the a-hole who comes back with tautologies and said, like, well, you must have done something, or there must be some simple explanation for this. From my memory of the book, like, there's not a very hopeful end for Job's friends.
Actually, God says, it's great. God says, this is what he says. He said, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken to me what is right as my servant Job has. Now therefore take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamanite went and did what the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. Yeah, he's really he's incredibly mad at them, and I feel like I could be wrong, but I feel like Alter or another commentator said like the sacrifices that he tells them to offer are pretty big. It's 7 bulls and 7 rams, which is a lot. That's a lot of meat. Exactly. So yeah, no, he is, and I mean, I do think there's. I do think there is something to sitting in silence, like in that beginning, and especially for someone who like has some theological training and other like whatever, like yes, like sometimes to just sit with someone, I think is it's very hard for me, it's very uncomfortable, because for the same reason I think like for the friends, I think their theological system helps them think as though or live under the impression they're holding suffering at arm's bay. They're holding and they have something figured out, but someone's undeserved suffering can be a threat, you know? And so for me to be like, oh, well, they have that because they did this, you know, like, oh, I got a tick bite this week because I walked the dog. Yeah. But it's like that only goes so far with some people and with people that are, so I wouldn't mind putting that out to the room. If anyone wants to, before we do another question, I just think that would be great for anybody to respond to. Yeah, Sarah. And then.
Well, I just wanted to, I guess, observe or ask further insight into how God, it seems like it's this humans putting themselves in the seat of judgment to be able to explain why suffering is happening, and then God sort of subverts that with Job, and then he entrusts judgment to Job in regard to his friends. Like, God withholds judgment of Job's friends and says, basically, like, I'll do what Job prays for you. That seems like there's something really profound in the, like, the establishment of a right relationship between God and Job. And what God then entrusts to a human who lays his hand over his mouth, in Job's words, like has that reordering of himself.
Mm-hmm. Like he hands the
hand the reins of judgment over to the one who has been judged. And that, like, his friends have judged Job, and so God says, all right, Job, now it's your turn. You may judge them.
But or does he'll have mercy?
Or, yeah.
You can see that, really.
Yeah, I think in some way, like, Job rightly experiences judgment before God. Or, like, he returns to, a posture of, like, oh, right, you're the only one who can judge because you're the only one who knows what all these creatures are doing and has the bigger picture on all of the suffering and all of the wildness and all of the chaos. And so, yeah. Anyways, I'm like, then it is, like, it is quite dignifying of Job that God would then be like, I'm partnered with this guy.
You know, there's a long tradition, or there's many characters who are the Lord's servants who suffer. I think of, like, and who suffer and then come out of the other side of their suffering and bless others and work for others' redemption, you know? Like, just think Joseph getting thrown into a pit, you know? And the way that Isaiah talks about the whole nation of Israel, which in, you know, the suffering servant, which we know is about Jesus. Like, there's a pattern in the Bible, and Job sort of, you know, Job fits into that, like, suffering on behalf of others, and then that suffering somehow leads to blessing of others too, especially those that had just kind of screwed you over, you know, and that enemy love that is very offensive and very Christian is throughout the Old Testament. And yeah, I mean, the power of forgiveness. And anyway, yeah, it's a wild scene. Yeah, Ben, did you want
to? Just a thought on, and it connects, I think it's connected to this, but it's the passage that Jared was talking back a few weeks ago about living in God's face and that resulting in you will, I forget what the language is, you'll find favor.
You'll be blameless.
And how, as you pointed out, some of the things that Job says throughout the book aren't actually theologically right. And yet, God at the end says, you spoke rightly of me.
Yeah.
And it seems to imply, if you put those two things together, it seems to imply that it's Job's attitude and where he places himself in God's face, that's what God judges as right.
Yeah.
Not necessarily everything he said.
Yeah.
It's that you won't let go.
Yeah.
And to me, it really ties in with, like, the difference between lament and grumbling in the Old Testament. Like, there's a difference between those two things. Mm-hmm. It's not that all complaint is great. You know?
Yeah.
The question is, who's the audience? Like, who are you talking to?
Yeah.
And if you go to God, and you won't get off the hook, and when you really have a problem with what's going on in the world or in your life, and you view God as the audience, and you go back to him again and again and again, even if you're saying things that are, you know,
yeah,
a little off there,
yeah,
you know, it's still, God still honors it,
yeah,
somehow. Whereas going,
he's not threatened by it, yeah.
Going to your tent and grumbling with your neighbors about how awful Aaron and Moses are, that's a different thing. That's, like, really not honoring to God, but it's the living in his face that's honoring to him, even if what you say there is sometimes, like, wrong-headed.
Yeah,
that's what's really, really profound.
Yeah,
because God is not saying at the end, "You silly friends of Job, Job had accurate theology, and you did not."
Yeah,
it's Job was in my face the whole time. You guys were talking abstractly about me, and you have no idea what you're talking about. Like,
Anyway,
it's really encouraging somehow.
Yeah. No, I really think it is. Like, he's, you said it really well. Yeah. Yeah, Marty, did you want to?
I just wonder, I'm thinking that the fact that nobody knows where Job was from. I mean, these were not Jews. These were not the nation of Israel. They didn't have the Jewish scripture.
Yeah.
And yet it makes me wonder whether their way of explaining suffering, whether there's something kind of universal in that, it goes very much with the kind of self-righteousness. People who are doing okay who aren't in suffering so much, like the friends who are, well, obviously you've suffered because this wouldn't be happening to you. And yet, the scripture itself doesn't let you get away with that. I'm just thinking Mary Frances' lecture on Proverbs, the wisdom literature, which will give the sort of the general rule, and then just blows it out of the water. In the next verse.
Yeah.
So, you know, it'll say the lazy man doesn't take care of his field and he'll be in poverty. And the next day it says the poor man works his field and injustice takes prosperity away.
You go to any major American city and you see homeless camps, and you just think, oh man, what, these people just screwed up. Like, what did they do, you know? They did something wrong, which I think they're actors in their own life. I'm not trying to say they're... But, like, there's just an impulse to be like, if someone's doing bad, if someone's struggling or suffering, it's like, oh, they did something wrong. And then if you see a fancy car or, like, a well-dressed person or... this is the lore of social media and some stuff, too. Like, people are presented very beautifully. Yeah. And they're like, oh, they're doing something right. And it's like, well... Actually, a lot of very crooked people are prospering.
And they have to do with why those people are homeless.
Yeah, but it's like an impulse. I feel like it's like an impulse in me. I just see it and I think,
It's just that the health and wealth gospel has absolutely no basis in scripture.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's just
there are, I do think there are some, there's varieties of suffering. So there are some, like, because we do have agency and we make decisions. And sometimes we make very bad decisions knowing there will be consequences. And sometimes we suffer because of that.
Exactly.
But that's not the only type of suffering, nor is that the pervasive or an explanation for why most people are suffering. I mean, a lot of people who are suffering today, just thinking about amazing amount of like refugees moving around the world, they're not displaced because they wanted to be or because they gambled on the stock market or something. Like, they're displaced because people who are in charge are... I mean, actually, it's above my head. I don't always know. But yeah, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was to introduce a whole other element of confusion.
Yeah, please.
Which is that we can look at Job's friends, and everybody who reads the book of Job and looks at their friends can condemn that. No, I'm not like that, even though they may be.
Yeah.
But it strikes me that a whole chunk of people in this world believe in reincarnation.
Mm.
And have a grip on the relationship between morality and suffering.
Yeah.
And explain it from beginning to end.
Yeah.
In a neat and tidy way, just like Jones' friends did. They're extending it out. over generations.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what are we dealing with there? There's something very, very somehow attractive.
Yeah.
That the person who believes in reincarnation is freed from the sort of stupidities of Job's friends.
Yeah.
But nonetheless.
Yeah, it's sophisticated. Really,
It's enormously sophisticated. But it's the world we're living in, and more, it's all around us.
But explain what that means, if people don't know. I mean, what karma means. Is that
it's just that you're...
You're deserving what you got in what you earned in your last life.
Yeah. I got to know a Buddhist pastor. I mean, a Christian pastor who'd been a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been, I think, in Vietnam or Laos, escaping after the disaster there with a whole lot of other his country people. Who conceived, given what they went through, the people who were really lucky all got shot and are dead. But we've had to live through this. And they got eventually to the Philippines, where they met some Catholic missionaries and explained something about Christian faith to them. And they saw, and what made the Christian faith believable to them is that what could we have possibly done in a previous life, all of us, to deserve the horrendous thing we've just suffered now.
Yeah.
How could we all have been so
immeasurably
bad?
Yeah.
that this has happened to us.
Yeah.
And so the Buddha's believability of the Buddhist reincarnation, karma, just escaped them, and they were open to the gospel, and they grasped the gospel. And here was a wonderful pastor, a Laotian pastor, who ex-Buddhist.
Yeah.
Grace, there's no grace in reincarnation.
Well, you know, it makes me think of, I think that I found it in John 9, where it's like, who sinned, this man or his parents? Like, that's how you explain things. Like,
that's right.
Yeah, it's right there, too. Yeah. Yeah. That's dirty.
In responding to what Vic is bringing up, I do think, and just this bigger question of, like, why is this such, like, seems like such a universal impulse?
Yeah.
Like, you know, bad behavior, merits, bad consequences, punishment. And I think part of it is not necessarily a negative thing, it's that we actually do long for justice.
Yeah.
There is a hunger for justice.
Yeah.
That the good things will be rewarded, good behavior will be rewarded, good effort, whatever will be rewarded, and evil will be punished. But the question then is, how do we make sense of the world that we see? Because it's not a one-to-one. It's not that big assumption like the Bible tries to think that it's a one-to-one correspondence that we see in our time, in the time frame that we have. But there is this deep desire for justice that I think that's actually valuable and important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a desire for something that just like can make sense of the world. Mm-hmm. I think it's why people are drawn to all sorts of various fundamentalisms. Because it explains, it gives answers to things that seem inherently ambiguous and confusing and mysterious, or paradoxical, and it can resolve some of that. And
I'm just thinking, going back to one of the things you said, which hadn't occurred to me before, but I think is really true in some cases. Because I think I agree with all these insights about why we tend to want to make sense of the world or correlate bad behavior with judgment in this life and everything. But I do think there's a self-protective thing going on with Job's friends, like because. If they can locate something Job has done wrong that warrants all of this suffering, they can continue to believe things are going well in my life because I'm good.
Yeah.
And that's what they want to hold on to.
It's a security blanket. That's cozy.
And the way I know I'm good is because things are going okay. My wife hasn't died, my kids haven't died, my I'm not diseased. And therefore it's just an indication that I'm doing well before God.
Yeah.
And that's I think that was really a good insight. I appreciate that insight. Like, whoa, if I'm forced to acknowledge that my friend Job here has really not done anything, well, he's living righteously before God, and yet this happened to him, then it calls into question my own righteousness.
Yeah.
And no matter how good I try to be, that might happen to me.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And that's just, they don't want to think about
it.
They don't want to go there.
They end up in a pretty bad spot.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Roscoe?
So how do you think, like, chapters 3, 7, 10, even God's kind of response to Job, how do you think that informs a Christian's prayer life?
That's a great question. Yeah. When you say God's response to Job,
disaster strikes, darkness persists, but also kind of like when the fog lifts, and kind of see just the flip side of the coin is the right term, but just see the breadth of God's kind of presence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great question, and I would be open to if anyone else has any thoughts on that too. But or do you already? Yeah, go for it. I've spoken a lot.
You can continue your
thought. Oh, my thought was just it gives, especially in moments of really profound personal loss and catastrophe, a real reason to be honest and to call God pretty directly to account. I mean, the prayer throughout, there's so many prayers in Scripture, like, where are you? Why don't you wake up? Like, what is going on? Or how long? How long is this going to go on? And I don't think, I think they give a precedent to be able to, it gives a precedent to be honest about grief and to be honest about what hurts. I mean, in Job in chapter 3 really does, and in 7, 7, he speaks out of the bitterness of his soul. And he actually says he feels like God is treating him like Leviathan, like God is more like Leviathan than God. I think it allows us a real honesty. Like, there's an old Testament scholar named Walter Brueggemann who's written about lament and says that there's lament prayers, so that, like, we see in, like, the Book of Lamentations or throughout a lot of Psalms, and his basic structure is, like, we have some orientation to life, suffering happens, we're disoriented, and we have to be honest about the disorientation. And God meets us in that place, and then there's some sort of reorientation. Like, that's his three-part scheme. I feel like Job is sort of like orientation, disorientation, then he has this encounter with God, second disorientation, and then some sort of reorientation. But what I like about what Brueggemann does is it allows you to be honest in the places where you actually are. And the hope is that, I mean, and I think the experience of suffering, I mean, the experience of reading Job, we've talked about this, is just, like, it's dizzying. It just sort of keeps going and going, and you're lost, and you're treading over old arguments again, and you're just not really sure why he's saying this again. It sounds like it's slightly different, but it's, and there's something about that experience of reading Job that I think matches the experience of suffering. You just feel like it's never going to end. You're just wandering in darkness. And
could it be understood as, like, one big lament?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. Yeah, very much so. But lament is, yeah, like Ben was saying, it's not just grumbling. It's not just me, like, grumbling to Sarah in our kitchen late at night, which happens enough. but it's like bringing it to the Lord in God's, like, living in God's face, like Jaredon said. And, yeah, I feel like I'm just repeating it, but what were you going to say?
Well, this whole conversation has been specifically with that person, Roscoe, and you and Jared at our lunch table, you brought up lament, and then Jared brought up really a whole image of having, like, the vocabulary of lament, but also the vocabulary of delight, and, like, how do we learn that and use both of those vocabularies. This is kind of our conversation, part of our conversation, if you all remember. And, like, it's been really helpful to hear you talk about this, because we think there is so much of this vocabulary of lament in Job and in the Psalms of lament, but there's also this vocabulary of delight, which comes in when God's talking about his own creation.
Yeah.
But then also with what you pointed out with the names at the end, Job has learned a vocabulary of delight eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And part of his reorientation.
Yeah.
But those phrases, I just wanted to shout out these people who brought this up at lunch. Because I think that's, I don't know, I'm mulling that over a lot, and that's been really thought-provoking to me.
Yeah, I mean, I do think they have to inform prayer in, like, yeah, again, I like the song Blessed Be the Name of the Lord, like the Matt Redman. It's actually on a playlist that I listen to. And I'm not, yeah, embarrassed about that. But it is, you know, it is the closest thing I know of, apart from a recent album by this group called The Porter's Gate that Mary Frances told me about, that gets anywhere close to talking about the dark side of life, but in the context of worship. Like he says, when I'm lost in the wilderness or found in a desert place or something like that. And there's a lot of life that's like that. And it does sort of feel like, in regards to like having a vocabulary, like if we don't have words or songs or poems or a vocabulary of any sense to make sense of those things, like, I mean, I know how I medicate away my pain, and I know how a lot of other people medicate away their pain, but that's like not living life in God's face or living life fully, you know? And so I think that can be a gift that lament does on the way to, with the end of like getting a vocabulary of delight. Is that what you said? Like moving, like not necessarily just staying in it forever, not just being a cynic or an Eeyore or negative or whatever, like just dark, like or reveling in darkness, but being able to name it, like being able to name it for what it is and to bring it towards the Lord. Yeah, Michaela?
I think the language that I found helpful in talking about when praying through your grief is not the question why, but I wonder what you're doing in this, God.
Yeah.
And that posture of staying in a conversation.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder what, because it's still, and you're still referring to God in as an active participant instead of like, why me? Like, I wonder what you're doing in this.
Yeah.
And I feel like the friends sort of mansplain everything.
Yeah.
There's no, I wonder what God's doing in this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's really, yeah. I mean, there's a, we long for reconciliation in all things. And I feel like there's just so much we don't get. And the friends are like, well, we'll reconcile this. Like, this is a this.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just being okay with not knowing. Like, I wonder what you're doing. And that should inform our prayer life as well as sitting with people in grief. Like, don't be a Job's friend and, like, connect people's behavior with what's happening in their life.
And, that reminded me of, there's a pastor named Peter Gregg, and he has a book called God on Mute, which is a book about unanswered prayer. And he says the question, and his wife has a long-term, she's chronically ill. I forget what she has, but she's lived with it for 25 years and in pain, or 20 years or something. But the question they pray is where? Just where are you, Lord? Where are you right now? Where are you with this pain? Which to me sounds a lot like your question of what are you doing? Like, not just why, but like where and what are you at? Like, give us, so he just gave that as other, I think, Do you want to say a little more or respond just because it's your question?
Thing, Job does go to the far ends of the west, the east, the north, to the south, searching for the Lord, but also kind of like turning the Lord's words against him, I think is maybe an important thing.
Yeah.
I never really heard it that way.
Yeah.
But, I mean, so it was kind of a challenge to the Lord.
Yeah.
And so I guess there's just a varying degree of nature.
Yeah.
And I guess those more intimate conversations that you have with God and not with your neighbors, you know, and other maybe even religious figures in your life.
I mean, I mean, a hope of having, you can't have an actual embodied friend or companion in it, like at least some of finding some solace in the words of Scripture, whether it's Job's longer laments or other lament psalms that are pretty intense. Just to find some company, I guess, or realize you're not alone. Because I find I don't have a problem expressing my anger to other people, but I struggle, to be honest, to be angry in prayer with God. Sometimes I just feel like I'm just like, oh, what's the point? Which is, so like when there's students here that tell me about how they've yelled at God, I'm like, holy cow, you think God is that real? Like, that's amazing. Like, I'm just like I'm in awe of that faith. Like, to be honest, I think I've been really yeah, honestly, quite chastened by it and challenged by it, and realized how complacent and comfortable and how quickly I give up in prayer. So, yeah, Mary Frances, Regan.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, too, your mention of the Porter's Gate album, it's called Sanctuary Songs, the album that Joshua was referring to, but one of the songs on there that I love the most, the title of the song is Christ is Lower Still. And I think I just would want to make the jump to the New Testament from this, and that like, Christ has been in the low places. So I think when we are in a Job-like place and we're praying to God, but we also have Christ with us and Christ interceding for us, who has, like, that the chorus of that song is Christ is lower still. You know, that Christ has been there. One of the most, like chastening moments to me as a livery worker was years ago in a tutorial with a student who was describing a really difficult season, and she used the words of, like, being in a pit. And I said to her, like, as a note of encouragement, like, Jesus sees you. Like, Jesus sees you. And she said back to me, yeah, he's in the pit with me. He's in the pit next to me. Oof. Oh, my God, yeah, he is. Yeah, yes, you're right, he is. Like, his hands are as muddy as yours are. And I think that's just an important piece of prayer.
Would you say a word about the video?
Yeah, oh, my gosh. Yeah, I will. So you guys can find this on YouTube if you want, but so the Porter's Gate is like a musical collective, and they released an album last year called Sanctuary Songs that was done in conjunction with an organization called Sanctuary Mental Health Ministries. So all the songs are written kind of through the lens of sort of a mental health piece, and it's a beautiful album. I'll just confess, I don't listen to a lot of Christian music, but it's one that I go to often. But there, you can find on YouTube this particular song, Christ is Lower Still. They performed it live in London, and Isaac Wardell, who's kind of the one who directs it, in the video on YouTube, you get a snippet of him introducing the song at this concert, and he talks about this statue. I can't remember the artist's name, but it's a life-size statue of Jesus that has been sunk to the bottom of the sea off the coast of Italy by an Italian sculptor. And it's this beautiful, quite lifelike sculpture of Jesus, like, looking up and with his arms up like this. But the sculpture is actually at the bottom of the ocean. And just that sense of, and I think it was originally done as sort of in conjunction with, like, sailors who had been lost at sea, those who've been lost at sea, and Jesus being with them. But I can't remember exactly. Isaac Wardell talks about it in a really beautiful way, but just that the sense of, like, Jesus is also at the bottom of the sea.
Yeah. However far you go down,
yes,
he's gone deeper, waiting there, and he has his arms up for you.
I think there's a line in the song that talks about that Jesus has gone deeper still. So whatever depth you have gone, Jesus has gone deeper.
Yeah.
To a further depth. And if you just find, on YouTube, Porter's Gate, Christ is Lower Still, you can see hear the song, but see the whole video with that. But I just think that's also just an important, you know, again, in our jumping from the Old Testament to New Testament, but that sense of, like, that's what we have in Jesus.
Yeah, there's a beautiful line in that song that sort of, with like, the student you said, where it's like, humbly, lowly, Jesus waits in the valley. It's like, you're heading to you're headed to the valley, and it's like, he's already there, and he's waiting for you. It's quite beautiful. But Marty, you keep.
No, I was just going to say that there have been times, and I think it's, you know, it may be a good thing to do. Someone raised the question of how this could inform our own prayer. When I found it really helpful to really just take the time to read through and meditate slowly on that God's chapters, God's questions at the end, because there's everything that you all have been saying, you know, about being honest with God about our doubts and our questions, but also to at times to just put ourselves where we listen to God's questions to us. To it was very humbling, and as you pointed out, I think, so well, something in that encounter absolutely changed Job. And it changed him before he got everything back.
Yeah.
And it changed his perspective. It gave him a humility. It gave him a, you know, and then eventually a joy. But just there are times for me it's been, I know just because of where I'm at in my thinking or my questions, or that it's been a good, that I think it's time I should just go spend some time with Job 41 and listen to those questions. Was I there when God laid the foundation for this? Bill McKibben wrote a really wonderful book about Job. I forget the name of it.
Comforting Whirlwind.
Yeah, Comforting Whirlwind. It's really fresh.
Oh, I don't know.
But
short book.
It's very short, and it's very, very fresh. But I mean, one of the main things I remember about it is his picture of God delighting in baby vultures sucking blood.
Yeah.
And just the God's delight in every aspect of his creation.
The wildness of it.
The wildness of it, the untamableness of it, the fact that and I often think of, you know, only God knows how many creatures there are at the bottom of the ocean that no human being has ever seen or knows about. I'm always excited when there's some new species discovered. God made that species and delighted in that species, and it's completely not dependent on us. But God delights in it, loves in it, and some of those creatures are the weirdest looking things.
Very strange.
You go to the aquarium, you think, what?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, what an imagination.
Yeah.
God, but just at times, that's, I think,
a
helpful thing to do.
I think those verses, those questions are humbling, but they're not humiliating.
They dignify
Job, and this guy, I don't totally, anyway, this guy Ortlund talks about the questions, almost like a coach or a teacher that's like coaxing the answer out of you, and it isn't just like, where were you? Do you know this? But it's sort of like, do you know? You don't know. It's okay. He is a Hebrew person, or a Hebrew scholar, so I don't really know all these things. But he talks about how there's a gentleness actually through these questions that are intended to humble, but again, not humiliate or shame.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, Ben.
I really like what you're saying about how this is about living, getting in God's face kind of, and living in his presence, even with our complaints. But another part of me kind of feels like, why even bring my prayers to him? Mm-hmm. Like, and when God wiped out all of Job's people, like his livestock and everything, his kids, he killed all the servants of the swords, the Chaldeans and the Sabians, and he destroyed them with a holy fire from the air. It's like these people, they were just doing their job, and they got, and I understand, like God hammers this home that like, who are we to question it?
But
at the same point, I'm kind of like, why does God hear my prayers? Why would he, why bother praying this if he is so unknowable and like might have so many reasons, and he's kind of doing this as like a side bet with Satan to be like, oh, like this completely other person, Job. Like, there's a part of me that wonders, like, why should I even continue praying if all this can be taken away?
Yeah.
And it's completely beyond my comprehension.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that question is very much the heart. It's close to the heart of the book of Job. The whole book is asking, is asking you to wrestle with. And yeah, how do you live in a world that you can't be insulated from suffering or protected from it? And what does it look like to walk with or to trust a God whose ways we don't know? And so the book is, I think, an invitation to that sort of questioning, exactly, like in one's own life. And I, Yeah, I don't. I would hesitate to say God. Part of the nature of how Job loses everyone. I don't know if I would just say God killed them, because there's like multiple agencies at work, either natural forces or like the Sabaeans and all these people that you said, and like this fire from heaven. And I don't think the implication is that like they didn't matter. They're just sort of props for this divine game the Lord is playing with Job. But I do think the book is, in many ways, an invitation to wrestle with these things are going to happen to you, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, and to the extent that they happen to Job, maybe never. Like, Job's suffering is, I think, exceptional in its, like, quantity, but sort of the quality of things that he loses are things everyone will lose, maybe not in the same intensity of things all at once. So yeah, how do we live in that world? Like, it's a very real, I don't want to answer pretend to answer a question that the book itself doesn't in some ways I do think honors, like, I think it raises that question, and isn't trying to belittle people that ask that question or anything like that, but it does. I just see two hands that are like.
Yeah, I struggle with that too, because I think what I found helpful is that the book of Job is a whole book dominated by the story of Job. Mm-hmm. As you say, they seem like just props, bit parts, but with God being God, you could have written something the size of the book of Job about any one of those kids. Mm-hmm. He was focused as much on every one of their kids as he was on Job. Wasn't that Job was a special person. He was specially connected to every one of them and could have given you endless whatever, about how their lives were developed. And as you said, these are things that happen to us all. And just so I think the thing we need to really be careful of is their stage props. Mm-hmm. Because the God who knows them as well as he knew Job cares as much as them about them as he cared about Job.
Because if you don't ask that question, like the setup, I don't want to talk about like it's like the setup of the story doesn't work. Like the story, like if you're not bothered by the fact that these children die, that he loses everything, all for like the story sets that up so that you're bothered by it. And that is, I think, like, pulls you into some of the story, and it resists answering that for reasons that I would love if it answered it, to be honest, having wrestled with it, or having read it. I don't know how well I've wrestled with it, but it, like, that you have that feeling is, I think, a sign that you're alive, like, and you're taking the book seriously and taking your own life seriously. But the book, I think, you know, yeah, we could say, look, this is not the only book about suffering, in the Bible, you know, moving to the New Testament, even the stuff we were talking about Jesus, but it, and I think there's a space for that, and that's good, but I think the book in many ways is an invitation to wrestle with this God, and who shows Job that he's about battling this sort of evil, this sort of chaos, that it lives in this world, it resides here, but his plan was not for it to be here, and he wants to do something about it. But I just want to say, I think being bothered by it is a sign that your moral compass is aligned. Whatever, if compasses are aligned, I don't know what it, or oriented. Yeah.
We should be bothered about Haiti, Gaza, Ukraine. Yeah. What's going on today, right now?
Refugees, people drowning every day.
Yeah.
And just bombs dropping on a building of 25 people, they're all dead.
Yeah. And, yeah, did you? Yeah.
Yeah. So, just to. A lot of what I was going to say has been said, but basically, your question about why pray really stood out to me in that. And the best guess, and again, take this with a grain of salt, but my best immediate gut response was relationship. So in the prayer, well, it's unknown why he's doing all this, and it feels like a distance has been reached between you and God, and it makes it feel like prayer, sure, like I can throw something across the distance, but like he already knows it, but I don't get to know him. And so that distance just grows in depth, and so it feels farther and farther away, and you're suffering, and it just feels like this chasm. But I think the reason to pray is a means by which you can build the bridge across that. You can realize and know intimately more and more, even if you don't understand it all, the depth of his love, and how he does care about each and every of the people who did die. And the unknowability becomes less important as presence overtakes, and the knowledge of his being there overwhelms. And so the relationship grows in the place where the yearning for answers once was, and that can really help heal. And that's why I think prayer is really important, even though it feels like, oh, well, we feel like on very different planes of existence, and it's hard to just pray.
That question, and I think it's the right question, makes me think of just the practice of communal prayer and the use of books of common prayer or written prayers,
really helpful.
Joining in with the prayers of the saints when you just don't want to talk to God. And I think that's sometimes that's fine. You go to your brother or sister and say, I can't talk to him right now. Would you please talk to him for me? I think there's room for that. And there's also prayers written for just these times that remind us, yes, this is really confusing and I don't know what's going on here. And I'm not the first one to struggle with this. This isn't the first time this thought has come up. God is familiar with this.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe this is also going to Roscoe's thing, Roscoe's question. I hope this isn't heretical. God doesn't ask us to always like him, like, and like everything he's doing. I think, obviously the... There's the Shema, the daily prayer of the people of Israel. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, or the Lord our God is one. You should love the Lord your God. Like, God is calling for love and this reciprocal relationship. But there's so many people in the scriptures, Job included, Jesus included. Jesus in the garden. I don't want this to happen. Jesus is known. In Mark, from chapter 9, he's like, look, I'm going and I'm dying. And people are like, no, don't. And he's like, you don't understand. And he's known what this is. He knows what's ahead of him. And he doesn't like it. And that's a pretty legitimate, if Jesus can pray, it's a pretty legitimate prayer. Anyway, yeah, were you going to say something, Sarah? And then Ben?
Yeah. Because now that we're talking about the first chapter, it does just occur to me too that there's a bookending of delight. What's accused, or like the, like God is delighting in Job, and then it's the accuser who
is cynical of that. And so it's sort of like, it's God's delight and any possibility of mutual delight between God and Job that is accused and is on trial now. And so that even like God's poems, his speeches are like these lavish delightings in his creation, and then that Job names his daughters these words of delight.
Dove, cinnamon, and horn of eyeshadow.
Yes! Those are the ones.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It, very fascinating.
I don't know. I'm like, that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, go back to the poem you started with. Like, I want to learn with a sharp pain precision. I want to learn a language of delight. I want to learn to speak about what is good with the same kind of thoroughness and specificity that is my native tongue of pain. Yeah. You know? How do you get there?
Yeah. How are you gonna just say great, wonderful. I have no words. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I just think that line's really funny. Sorry. Yeah, Ben Kaiser, are you going to say something?
Yeah, I just thought you mentioned Jesus in the garden, but also Jesus on the cross. I mean, the Christ of dereliction is, in a sense, the truly holy one. I don't care how righteous Job was supposed to be, but like, Jesus is the one that actually truly lived the fully righteous life before the Lord, and is abandoned by God, and cries out the same question that isn't answered. Why have you forsaken me? To some degree, obviously, Jesus knows why he's on the cross. He knows that his death is a sacrificial death, but it's not just like a question for the edification of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
It is like a legitimate, horrifying abandonment.
Yeah.
And he doesn't give an answer. And that to me, like the whole discussion of the problem of evil, and like how can God be powerful and good and these things happen? So, I mean, similar to the Book of Job, it does not give us an answer. The Christian faith, the whole biblical story, doesn't give us an answer that's satisfying if we need to know why. But it does show you Christ, who actually not only experienced the worst in a completely undeserving way, but asked the same question. Like, it's like God himself on the cross asked the same question that we get into a tangle about, you know. And amazingly, it's that moment, his sacrificial death, that actually resolves the whole question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is like the nail in the coffin of evil and the devil. Which I think that's, it's certainly not a quick philosophical or satisfying philosophical answer for the conundrum of the problem of evil. But there isn't. That's just not going to happen. But we have the story and we have the person of Christ.
Christ's death makes a community of people that value and care for one another's suffering. And ideally, I mean, the church can also be the source of quite a bit of suffering in people's lives, but ideally can be a place where others can, whether they literally sit with you in silence for 7 days, they at least help carry some of the burden. You like carry your sufferings so you're not alone in it. I think that is a tremendous gift that Christianity gives, that maybe not sort of if first order matters is sort of a tight philosophical explanation of evil. Well, we at least have a second order of like resources to help you live in a world where there's a tremendous amount of evil. And maybe that is meal trains, or someone to cry with, or I don't know. It can be any number of things. We talked at breakfast the other day about Christians being at the origins of hospitals, right? Isn't that what we sort of, caring for, Sung Jin?
Yeah. I just wanted to add to what Ben was saying earlier about kind of like what God is kind of asking us to do, kind of, you know. And the whole entire book of Job is very interesting in the fact that it raises a lot of questions, you know, and it doesn't really answer most of them, but I think what it's trying to do is, you know, this is really cool word that I actually learned about in my college class, and although it's not really Christian in nature, I think it does relate to the book of Job, which is chronotope. And chronotope is this amazing...
Chronotope?
Yeah, chronotope. It's this word that describes kind of like a time period in which that, like, you can tell stories and stuff. And I feel like that's what God is trying to do with the Bible. It's creating chronotopes where he's giving us space where we can question kind of and like produce works of art, you know. And chronotope, it's not just about like raising up questions and like, but it's also like about like, you know, producing works of art, you know, not as a means of selling them for monetary value or anything, but like, you know, to kind of like reinforce the idea of like of these stories that are being told. And I feel like God is really kind of calling us to do this, especially in the book of Job, you know, because, you know, it's kind of, there are going to be naysayers and people that will, you know, kind of say, kind of like, you know, kind of push against, you know, the power of evil and stuff and that type of stuff that we explored in the book of Job. And what God is trying to say is like, you know, like, he's kind of saying to Job and to us and everybody, like, you know, hey, this is your moment, you know, this is your time to shine, to like, kind of like, raise up these questions and have a thoughtful discussion, you know, and use your skills of poetic, you know, discourse or what have you, whatever skills you have been blessed with, to try to disquell and also like dispel these arguments, you know. And I just thought that was very interesting, you know, with the book of Job and how he uses poetic words, you know, and different strange ways to kind of explain to Job what he's doing wrong, like describing the Leviathan and also kind of, you know, mocking it kind of in a sense, you know, like we explained with the great hooks and harpoons and its lips and its mouth and stuff. I just thought that was very interesting, you know.
Yeah, and it's like, sometimes I've never heard of that term before, so that is something to...
Chronotope.
But yeah, like, the book of Job is, I sometimes think, like, one day someone, like, was sitting at a desk, and, like, the Holy Spirit zaps them, and they're like, you know, their eyes go in their head, and then they just, like, write out a book of the Bible or something like that, you know, like, and if you want to waste a tremendous amount of your life, you can read about how scholars make sense or present theories on how texts were assembled and what, like, they're just so presumptuous. But it's clear that it's like, it wasn't just someone sitting one day and just took out a piece of paper and wrote the book of Job in one sitting, or wrote the Gospel of John in one sitting.
Yeah.
I mean, probably Paul wrote some of his letters or had them transcribed in one sitting, but that's a slightly, you know, different genre. But, like, it does seem like someone really spent a tremendous amount of time getting these words of Job and getting them in such deliberate, you know, poetic, like, took a tremendous amount of care to present this as, like a beautiful piece of art that compels someone not just on like a cerebral level, but hits them on a more holistic level. Like, there's like a power to the words and a power to the imagery and to the language. So, yeah. Anyway, your thoughts about moments that create other things is, yeah, I think really, yeah, really interesting. Yeah, Marty.
Just one thought I wanted to, following up on what Ben was saying about the cross, is that I think it's Tim Keller has made this point.
a number of times, which I just find so helpful that we don't get a nice, neat, you know, rational answer to the problem of evil. But one thing we, because of the cross, one thing we can absolutely know for certain, that it's not because God doesn't love us.
Yeah.
It's not because God doesn't love us and doesn't care, because he went to the cross for us. And yeah. Jesus suffered he suffered hell. He suffered complete being separated from the Father, being judged by the Father, bearing the sins of the world that he didn't deserve. Judgment of God and abandonment, which, because he was abandoned, we never have to be abandoned. So we can know that he's with us. So we can know that. There's a lot we can't know, but we can know that it's not because he doesn't love us.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's really good. Thank you. That sounds like a Tim Keller thing.
Yeah, like the hammers like on that.
Yeah, no, it's really good.
But we need to be hammered with it. We signed it.
Yeah. Does anyone else have anything else? Otherwise, I think we've been going for a good while. So,
thank you, Joshua.
Yeah, cool. All right. Thank you all for coming.